Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
So I had an email from a listener named Ashley, and she asked the question, "Hey Seth, have you ever heard of EFT, also known as tapping?" Just stop. Just don't, okay? I see your face. I see that smirk, right? Tapping, a little base level humor, haha. No, stop it. Stop it. Tapping. EFT. Well, I hadn't heard of it, so I looked it up. Did you know that WebMD has a straight-faced page on this? And I think this is one of the reasons that we have to approach, you know, sites like WebMD with a grain of salt, right? Because, I mean, I was waiting for the debunking. But no, Dan Brennan, MD, posted an article on this back in October of last year. EFT stands for Emotional Freedom Technique. The procedure was patented by another doctor, Roger Callahan. He called it thought field therapy. And already you can hear, you can feel the woo coming in, right? You can feel it's an avalanche of woo is about to smother us all. Okay. EFT, or tapping. It falls along the lines of disciplines like yoga, tai chi, and acupuncture. It relates to the mind-body connection. Oh yes, there are energy flowings that are happening along these meridians within the body. And if you do tapping, it's supposed to help relieve stress, depression, anxiety, psychological disorders like PTSD. Holy shit, you've got PTSD. People can tap you to wellness. And tapping can be done via the acupuncture method, where they actually stimulate these meridians or flows or whatever, this energy thing. They can do it with needles, or they can just sort of tap you with their fingers at certain pressure points of the body, hence the word tapping. Some scientists believe, and again, I just want to find the author of this article and just smack him. Like, you know, slap him back to consciousness, because this guy says some scientists believe that it works because it stimulates the central nervous system and causes the body to release helpful chemicals. And there's like a procedure for this. EFT tapping sessions follow a set sequence. First of all, you say out loud what's on your mind. I'm distressed by this. I have anxiety about that. And you list it all out and you rate it 0 to 10. And then you say your setup statement. This identifies the problem and says you accept that it is the problem. Next up, you will begin your tapping sequence. And again, just stop. Okay. Tapping sequence, tapping with the fingers. You tap on specified sites in the body, and then as you tap, you have a reminder phrase to help you focus on the problem area. So let's say you're stressed about the kid going to college. So it's like tap, 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 my daughter's going to college. Tap, 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 my daughter's going to college. Tap, 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 my daughter's going to college. And then when it's over, at the end of this sequence, then you give another rating. Well, you know, I started with an 8, but now I feel a 3 or a 4. Wait a minute. We still have more to do. So they continue to tap with their fingers until your distress rating is a 0 or a 1. The bullshittery is strong with this one, my friends. Now, does WebMD pause at this moment in the article and say, I don't think any of this has been peer-reviewed or lab-tested, and we have real concerns that the claims and findings are rather unscientific. Absolutely not. There is a line in the article that says studies show that EFT tapping can improve psychological disorders. Further research is needed. Well, I would say so. I'm definitely going to need some further research on EFT tapping. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if this stuff worked? You know, I can't afford my car repair and just like, you know, I'm having relationship problems. I just finished the last episode of Ozark, and now I've lost my will to live. Don't you wish that worked? Wouldn't that be nice? Just tap your way to happiness. Tap, tap, tap. So I guess that's a good setup for the rest of the broadcast as we talk about pseudoscience, bad science, non-existent science, woo, and wacky stuff that's going on all around us. How to see it, how to approach it, how to debunk it. And my special guest is, I guess I'd call him a professional, or at least almost full-time debunker. His name is Timothy Caulfield. He's always a blast to talk to, and he's always got so much good stuff to offer. There is video of this conversation. That link is in the description box. My special guest today is a Canadian professor of law at the University of Alberta. He has a bunch of credits, including research director of its Health Law Institute. He holds several positions related to health law and policy. He is a fellow of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, and I have to say it that way because I can't say the word inquiry. Timothy. He's a popular columnist, TV personality, debunker. He's authored several books, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. Timothy Caulfield, thank you so much for joining me, my friend.
Thanks for having me on, Seth.
Okay, I want to start with the guy on the airplane. I mean, it's just going to dive right in. You posted a story, or was it a video? There's a guy on the airplane who got rescued by a chiropractor. And I must know more. What happened?
Oh, that was actually a post from a friend of mine that I reposted. Completely ridiculous. There's this individual has a cardiac event on an airplane. And as I understand it, it's hard to get a sense of what really played out here. But, you know, several MDs tried to help him. And then finally, a chiropractor comes to the rescue and he feels better. And the chiropractor posts, you know, the role of, you know, chiropractics in these kinds of situations shouldn't be underplayed. You know, thank you for my healing hands. And it's viewed it as a great promotion for the power of chiropractic. Of course, what happened is, you know, he was the last person to touch the individual. And so therefore, it's, you know, causation illusion, right? And so he's taking credit for the person feeling better, but a really good example of, you know, the absurdity of a lot of the alternative practitioners out there, and also how they perceive their practice and how they perceive their role. It really is absurd.
I'm taking it in the teeth anyway. We've been going hard on chiropractic for almost a month now, and I can hear people clicking out because they're pissed off, but I'm just going to let it hang out there. You've been host or one of the featured hosts of this TV show called A User's Guide to Cheating Death. And I'm interested in that because it sounds even more exciting than Naked and Afraid. I mean, you know what I'm saying? You're cheating death. Tell me about this show. I mean, what is it, man?
Yeah, so unfortunately we're not producing it anymore, and I there's even a little bit of a pandemic story to this. I'd written the next, you know, season three, and I was actually flying to Toronto 2 years ago. What was it? March 15th? When was it? The day.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. That was the day I was flying to Toronto. So, you know, unfortunately, we haven't really got it rolling again, just the momentum because of the pandemic. But the show really was about going around the world and trying to experience these different approaches to health. And, you know, we went from high tech to unproven stem cell therapies to traditional Chinese medicine in Hong Kong to Reiki in Japan. And Seth, we really did try to approach it with a little bit of empathy, you know, really did try to go in with an open mind. And I absolutely loved the experience because, you know, I do empirical research at the university, but you've probably done this also in your life. You know, when you're shooting something like that, you spend the day with the practitioner, right? So you're chatting with them. And so I found it a really eye-opening experience. Because you get to really have this unvarnished view into their world, into their belief systems. You know, it's not a qualitative study or, you know, a survey or even a clinical trial. You're really getting to spend time with these individuals, these practitioners. And I would say of the ones that I spent time with, I'm going to say 75%, Seth, really believe it. You know, they really believe that they're doing good, and the other, you know, 25% they know that it's, you know, they're providing a service that people are interested in. The other thing reason I found it really rewarding was I'm going to say almost every single occasion was a positive experience. You know, I was, you know, lying on a bed in Kyoto and the music was playing, you know, as I'm getting my Reiki, and I nodded off a little bit. So I get it. These are positive experiences. People are paying attention to you. So it was kind of nice. That was very nice. But then, of course, in the show, what we ultimately do is we talk about what the science actually says. We try to, you know, investigate why people might be attracted to these types of therapies and approaches to wellness, but we really do try to be a little bit more empathetic than some of the other kind of debunking shows there. But I think we still land in the exact same spot.
I was interested in, like, I was in for dry needling, right? I was just going to give it a shot to see what it was like, and it's pretty intense. You know, I take these needles about yay long, and it's supposed to help alleviate back pain. And hell, I don't know what happened. I think it's all just a bunch of bullshit. But I was there. But I did have that experience. Like, you're being attended to, people, there's touch, there's comfort, there is music. And whether it was placebo effect or not, I found myself, it was kind of getting high on just being there, just feeling like I was being attended to. You probably felt the same way, right? You're on the table and you know, the Yanni music and the incense are going on, but you feel, I don't know, you feel kind of, I don't know, special. Is that a way to say it? I don't know.
So. Seth, I think you're exactly right. I think you nailed it. And there is this unbelievable placebo theater that surrounds all of these activities. And you know this too. You know, the research tells us this is one of the reasons people go to complementary and alternative practitioners, to functional, to integrative, whatever they're calling themselves now. Because, you know, they feel like they're not being listened to. You know, there's that classic study that says that in conventional healthcare system, physicians stop listening after 11 seconds. I'm sure you've heard of that study. Now, you know, there have been other studies that have kind of replicated that. So I think that the general thrust of that study is true. And that's what draws people to these practitioners. You know, when I went to the naturopath, I think I've been a couple now, you know, that was one of my first ones. So this is, you know, years and years ago. I couldn't believe how much time she spent with me. She has this beautiful office, and they spent an hour talking to me about my poop and my sleep and, you know, my sex life. And, you know, I like talking about me, as you're experiencing right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a couple of things, phenomenons. I saw something online, and I know there are exceptions. This is much more nuanced, but it said automatically rejecting what an authority tells you is not doing your research or thinking for yourself. It's not that we automatically blindly trust everything that comes down the pike from even the CDC, etc. But this automatic rejection, you know, Western medicine bad, Eastern medicine good. And of course, I don't differentiate. I mean, don't they practice the same medicine in China that they do here in the United States? Do you make a distinction?
No, I don't make a distinction. And that false dichotomy drives me nuts. And there are a lot of false dichotomies that the complementary and alternative medicine community uses to push their bunk. And you know, that's one of them, right? That there's somehow there are these different world views, and we have to be open-minded to both of them, and we're going to integrate, you know, East and West. But what's interesting, one of the things that I think has happened, and I wonder if you agree with me on this, doing that's become more has become more difficult for them, because increasingly they try to use sciencey language to justify their therapy. So I think, you know, when I first started doing this, you know, a long time ago, they were kind of saying, you know, this is a completely different philosophy. This is a different worldview. It's maybe it's more spiritual. They don't say that anymore. Right now, when they're pushing, whether it's chiropractic or a supplement or you know, whatever it is, it's about regeneration and stem cells. It's about the microbiome. It's about quantum physics. You know, it's they use all of these very sciencey things to try to justify what they're doing and give it a veneer of legitimacy. And to be honest with you, Seth, I like that, because it makes it much easier to say, look, you're gonna be held to the standards of science if you're gonna say this works in a measurable manner. If you're gonna start using this language, it's a lot easier to hold them to the standards of science. And I've seen that. We've actually studied this. We've looked at how alternative medicine practitioners use regenerative medicine and stem cell language in order to, I call it science exploitation, in order to push their bunk. And it does make, I think, our task much easier. It is sort of philosophically or maybe conceptually more difficult, not more difficult, but more challenging, when they're saying, look, this is a different worldview, this is a different philosophy, this is a spiritual approach to health. And if that's the case, you know, that's, you know, help yourself, go for it. But it raises interesting questions about its role in our science-based healthcare system, right? So I'm not saying that we still turn, you know, we turn a blind eye to that strategy, but it does change the arguments.
I would look forward to seeing sort of the scientific quantification for Gwyneth Paltrow's vagina candles, or, you know, whatever they're, you know, the rocks and those types of things, which brings me to, and if I hadn't already been a fan of yours, when I saw the title of your 2015 book, I would have immediately become a fan. What is the title of your 2015 book, Tim?
Is Gwyneth Paltrow wrong about everything? ?
Beautiful.
Now, that's for the lawyers out there.
Gwyneth
I think you
Paltrow's,
could have made it a declaration, right?
Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop is a company that is valued, Fortune magazine said it's valued at about $250 million based around the whole health and wellness thing. So what's your beef with Gwyneth Paltrow in a nutshell?
So when I wrote that book, I was actually using her as, and this was, you know, in 2015, right? So it was, you know, she hasn't really gained a whole bunch of momentum yet. You know, because you start writing, like, you know what it's like, you start writing about 2013 or whatever. And she was going to just be an example of the power of celebrity in this space, you know, the growth of the celebrity wellness guru. And she just is a really good example of that. And she's also a really good example of how these individuals fearmonger, you know, they leverage fear, they leverage frustration and concern with the conventional system. They use sciencey language to push bunk. She's just a good example of all of these cultural trends. And if you've read the book, you know, it's, she's just an example. The book actually goes in a lot of other different directions. But when I wrote it, I had no idea that she took off, right? You know, that company absolutely exploded while the book was kind of in production. So that sort of, you know, was kind of interesting to see happen. I did try to sneak into her office when it was in London. I did the whole kind of James Bond thing where I pretended I had a package that I put my foot in the door and I snuck in, and I wanted to see if Gwyneth was there. Of course, I knew she wasn't going to be there, but it looked exactly like you'd think the Goop headquarters would look. You know, I think the Yanni music was playing there.
Awesome. Too. Awesome. Let's talk about another woo meister, Dr. Oz, running for Senate. I just saw his campaign ad. It was so impressive. You know, he's riding a horse, and then he shot a gun, and then I saw there was an on-screen endorsement by Ted Nugent. I mean, gosh, and talk about a credibility builder. And you know, I feel the anxiety starting to build within me, you know, because a few years ago, I'd have thought, no freaking way. Does he have a prayer, right? 6 years ago, no way. And now I'm terrified. I did see that Columbia University dropped him. Is that right? What's the story on Dr. Oz and Columbia right now?
Yeah, that's my understanding. So I've only seen a couple of articles reporting on this. It's been reported in a number of places. And some people are criticizing Columbia because they did it very quietly, right? But as you know, really for a very long time, I'm going to say certainly since when he appeared in the Senate in 2014, there have been people pushing Columbia to sort of disassociate themselves with Dr. Oz. And it looks like they've finally done it. And I think it is because of exactly what you have pointed out. He's just become this GOP, you know, he's pandering. He's just pandering. It's like he's a satire. Like you wouldn't believe it.
If I can jump in quickly, do you think some of that has to do? I mean, I know he latched on to Reiki. You mentioned Reiki, and you know, the legit medical community at some point has to say enough. I mean, you think that plays into it at all?
I do. I think that that's why, you know, Columbia finally did it. You probably know this already. You know, they kind of brushed aside earlier calls to disassociate the institution from Dr. Oz because of academic freedom reasons and freedom of expression reasons. But it's just which I don't buy, by the way, because doctors are held to a certain standard. Look, I'm a big supporter of freedom of expression. I bet you are, too. But doctors are held to a specific standard. Like, you have a license, and with that license comes privileges, and you're held to a certain standard. So I think that licensing boards and the institution should have moved much earlier. You know, he pushed, you know, homeopathy. He's pushed unproven diet. And then early in the pandemic, he embraced hydroxychloroquine. And then he kind of has this, you know, he early days, he was pro-mask. But as soon as being pro-mask was bad for the GOP platform, he became anti-mask. Yeah, I mean, it's become ridiculous. As I said, it's like he's doing a satire of himself. It's just so, it's pathetic.
How much do you blame Oprah for this? Because I blame Oprah for a lot of his popularity.
I do blame Oprah. I don't think she gets enough blame for a lot of these things. And she platformed him, right? And she enabled him. And she's enabled, you know, Jenny McCarthy and other voices, right? And I think that matters. And I actually think it's sort of like the early Joe Rogan phenomenon, right? You know, where people have tried to say, you know, why are you picking on Joe Rogan? He's just asking questions, you know, he's just jacking off. if you allow Peter McCullough, if you say he can't have Peter McCullough on there, that's censorship. You know, if you say he can't have Robert Malone on there, that's censorship. When in reality, all we're asking for is sensible programming, right, Seth? You know, which happens all the time. It happens in newspapers. They make editorial decisions. You know, you decide who you're going to have on your show. That's a programming decision. That's all we're asking for, sensible programming decisions. You know, am I being censored because Tucker Carlson hasn't had me on his show yet? Is that censorship? Am I being silenced, Seth? I'm being silenced because Tucker hasn't had me on yet. So that's the same thing with Oprah. Like, she made these programming decisions early days that helped fuel the rise of pseudoscience.
No, I mean, in, you know, Rogan's another hot button, right? You just say his name and all the ocean parts and everybody starts lobbing grenades at each other. And I think it's a little bit nuanced. I've heard that sort of defense as well. Well, Rogan just wants to have conversations and he'll talk to anybody. And I'm like, well, you know, okay, in theory. And like, I won't let anybody tell me who I can and cannot have on this show. But I think what bothers me about Joe is when he highlights, I mean, the Alex Jones thing, right? I mean, the guy who called Sandy Hook the massacre of children a false flag, and you allow it, you give him a chair in your studio. I mean, at what point does you sort of have a societal contract? You know, at what point does giving this guy oxygen become really a disservice to goodness? And then there's the lack of really critical questions. I mean, he seems to just sponge up so much of the bullshittery that comes out of many of his guests with that challenge. So if you're going to bring him in, let's at least have a hard conversation. I mean, what's your take on Rogan?
You just nailed it. Okay. I agreed with everything that you said. You know, I fight misinformation. I feel very passionate about this. So I think a lot of people assume I embrace deplatforming and the idea that they, you know, on the contrary, you know, had Joe Rogan, had, you know, Robert Malone, Peter McCullough on, and he wasn't sort of cheerleading their pseudoscience. He wasn't sort of just embracing and amplifying the pseudoscience, but asking them tough questions, right? And saying, well, here's what the you know systematic review says about ivermectin and the study that you're highlighting has been found to be fraudulent or has been retracted. He didn't do any of that. Yeah. It's all cheerleading. And what is so important, I think, is in this age of misinformation is making sure that you use a weight of evidence approach whenever you're having these conversations, right? You say, here's what the body of evidence says, and what he doesn't even do false balancing. He just pushes the bunk, right? He champions the bunk. It's an advertisement for the bunk. And then he uses the idea of censorship and silencing as a shield. Never mind that he's the most popular podcaster. You know, these people go from Joe Rogan to Tucker Carlson, from the most popular podcast in the world to the most popular cable news show in the world. We should all be so silenced, right?
You know, I remember when Trump, violated repeatedly Twitter's terms of service, and they say, fine, you're out of here. And he says, you know, I'm being censored. I cannot be heard. And then he said so from the biggest podium in the United States, right, from the White House. And you think this is not a victim of cancel culture. This is just consequence culture. And I remember when I had a book called Confessions of a Former Fox News Christian that talked about the network, its origins, sort of its business model, and my own history with the network, not as a member of it, but someone who was sort of lapping it up every single day. I was that guy, right? I was the Bill O'Reilly guy. I was the Laura Ingraham guy, et cetera. Loved Sean Hannity, loved Ann Coulter. Oh, I used to be that guy, Tim. And I remember sort of, I threw a sort of a feeler out to Rogan's podcast. You know, would you allow me to come on the show to talk about this? And I never heard back. But I would go on Rogan's podcast, but with the commitment to my audience that it would not be the sort of blind, bland love fest, but we would be prepared for real challenge on the issues that matter. And I think that's the difference. So, you know, I used to be a Scott Adams fan. I want to call you Tim. Do you like Tim or Timothy, my friend?
Whatever you're comfortable with.
Oh, okay.
You can call whatever works for you.
Scott Adams is the guy who does Dilbert, the famous Dilbert comic strip. And I love Dilbert. I love Dilbert. I still love Dilbert. Scott Adams drives me crazy because this guy he's become a train wreck through a dumpster fire into the lobby of Mar-a-Lago. You know what I'm saying? What's the story with Scott Adams, Tim? What's going on?
It sounds like you know more about Scott Adams than I do. But what I will say is, it does this in this age of misinformation, you know, where this has become such a big part of our cultural conversations now. I actually think this is going to be one of the great challenges of our era. You know, how we navigate misinformation. You do find these individuals that you once, you know, enjoyed. And they take these strange positions. And can you separate you know, the art is Dilbert and art, the art from the person. So I was just before I came on, because someone sent me the link. One of my hate mailers, a regular hate mailer sent me the link to Russell Brand's podcast, right? Oh. So, you know, Russell Brand, I enjoyed him and a lot of, you know, the movies he's done. Get Me to the Greek is hilarious. But it's becoming sort of alt-right light. And it becomes hard. I know it's this libertarian take that he has, hard to take. Aaron Rodgers. I could go on and on and on. You know, Tom Brady.
Oh, I do the same thing with Mel Gibson, right? Yeah. Mel Gibson being exposed as just an awful human being. But whenever Braveheart comes on, and I know historically it's crap. Like, everybody, don't email me. I know that Braveheart is total bullshit. But I still love the movie, you know? And I go through that. Am I supporting this horrible person by watching one of my favorite films, you know, Road Warrior, one of the greatest movies ever made?
For sure.
And I go through that. And in some ways, I feel like kind of betrayed. Like, I can't enjoy it as much as I used to, because I see the guy who is the Holocaust denier, who blames the Jews for all the wars in the world, who's at, you know, domestic violence, all the other stuff that's going on. It's funny to watch the celebrities who sort of lined up with all of that. It's interesting to hear you mention it.
It is an incredible challenge. I mean, Aaron Rodgers is a really good example, because I have, I don't know if you do the same thing. I do have more, I'm less likely to react this way if they don't sort of advocate for it and just, you know, here's the shovel, keep digging. And which is what Aaron Rodgers did. He didn't say, I'm sorry about I lied about my vaccine. I should have, you know, shouldn't have done that. He said, you know, he started talking about ivermectin, and he started talking about the risks associated with the vaccine, and then he started talking about freedom of expression and cancel culture. He just kept digging, right? And then he became, it becomes hard to tolerate. Like, I'm originally from Boston, so, you know, big Patriots fan. And so my tolerance for Tom Brady's nonsense, people say, Tim, you're such a hypocrite. You're such a hypocrite. How come you have? I can see my Tom Brady doll right there, by the way.
Awesome. That's awesome. More with Timothy Caulfield in just a second. I want to talk about this generational thing. Like, are my parents more apt to fall for craziness than I am, or maybe the generations after me? Like, is it an age thing? We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more next. Hang on. I am so thankful for my patrons, wonderful supporters of this broadcast. If you are not a patron, I would welcome that support. You get the show 2 days early and you get it totally commercial free. Just sign up at patreon.com/SethAndrews. Continuing our conversation about bunk and how to debunk it. I think you may have some data on this. I don't want to sort of throw you out there and expose you in this way without maybe having the data in front of you. By the way, I'm talking with Timothy Caulfield. He is a professor of law and public health. He's an author. He is a debunker and a columnist. And he is, at this moment, not the hero we deserve. He is the hero we need. How likely are our parents to fall for misinformation over, say, us or our kids? Like, I've heard, well, you know, if you're 65 and older, you're a lot more likely to see the article from freedom.eagle.net, whatever, and believe it's true and share it, than somebody who is younger who might be more skeptical. Is there an age thing going on with misinformation out there?
So that's a great question, and you're going to hate my response because it's complex. You know, okay. I wish I could give you, like, the answer is, and that probably doesn't surprise you, right? So, in fact, there was a study that just came out, I'm going to say days ago, that kind of dispels that conventional wisdom, kind of. And I'll come back to the kind of in a moment. But it's a good news story, because what they found is that regardless of the age, people can apply the media literacy, critical thinking skills to be able to tease out what's real and what's not real, you know, tease out the misinformation from the good stuff. So that's good news, right? And kind of dispels the, the idea that, you know, the young are more savvy than the older. Having said that, the study also found for the, you know, the very old, I think it was 75 and above, they do have a tendency to fall for fake news more than the younger cohorts. In addition to that, I think it breaks down, if you look at other studies, it kind of breaks down depending on the topic. So as you probably know, with vaccines, for example, a lot of the, especially in Canada, a lot of the older cohorts were the ones that got the vaccines, right? Unless you're an old white Republican, the data is a little bit different. And that sounds like I'm being, you know, sort of pejorative comment there.
Kind of snarky,
but that's what
there,
the data tells us. It's pretty clear. It's pretty strong. And some of the younger community is more likely to believe the misinformation. So there's a lot going on there, right? They're just exposed to it more because they're just on, you know, they're on social media more. So a lot of the cognitive biases are coming to play. And also there might be that complacency element associated with, you know, when you're talking about vaccines and masks, et cetera. So unfortunately, it is quite complex. And I think the lesson that you take away from it is we've got to remember that you know, who falls for misinformation is not a simple story, and we have to remember that people across the political spectrum can fall for misinformation, and really people from across all demographics can fall for misinformation depending on their circumstance. So I do think, you know, as I said, you wouldn't like the answer. It's a lame answer.
I buy that. I know we live in a culture that loathes nuance. All right, we want it quick, we want it easy, we want it on a Twitter feed or a bumper sticker. By the way, speaking of Twitter, and I'm seeing this trend more and more, I'm noticing when I log on to the world in the mornings, I'm seeing the headlines along the lines of, this video was manipulated. This footage has been exposed as being altered. Here we are in the deep fake era, yeah. Right? I'm terrified. What happens if anybody anywhere can be made to say and do anything? Now the debunking becomes even harder, right?
It does become harder. And I'm always an optimist. You know, I don't know if you've probably in other forums you've heard me say this. You know, I believe debunking works. I believe that we can make a real difference, and I think the data backs that up. You know, that there are strategies that we can use to push back against the noise. But there are a bunch of trends, and that's one of them that are going to make it incredibly difficult. So people pushing misinformation are getting more sophisticated, and I mean that from nation states, right, down to individuals who are marketing bogus supplements. People are getting better at it. So that's scary. I also think that people are getting better at using our cognitive biases. So fear-mongering, you know, our negativity bias, the availability bias, all those things. You're seeing that strategy, you know, people utilizing those tendencies as a strategy to push misinformation. And the other reason, so we have, you know, deep fakes, we have all those kinds of developments that are going to make it really difficult. And the other thing I think is happening is ideology. I've been following misinformation in health for a very long time. There's always been an ideological component, no doubt about it. But holy cow, it's become all about ideology now, right? Who would have guessed, you know, Seth, if you could get in a time machine and go back 2 years and tell yourself ivermectin, you know, this anti-parasitic is going to become an ideological flag. Who would have guessed that? But that's where we are. You know, all of these debates now are about ideology, but, you know, from vagina eggs to ivermectin, it's all about ideology now. And unfortunately, I know you know this, but it's important to emphasize, once it becomes about ideology, it becomes much more difficult to debunk.
That's a great segue.
Much more difficult.
Great segue into something that I had seen you post, and I hadn't seen it framed this way, but I mean, we're tribal creatures, right? We evolved to be tribal, but we see anti-intellectualism becoming a tribe. Right? You got the QAnon tribe, you mentioned the ivermectin tribe. So it becomes then a social exercise, an emotional exercise. It's funny when you see it in that way. So now, you know, when you're banded together in a reinforcement culture, you've outgrouped everybody who disagrees with you. There's a sense of superiority that comes when you think you've outsmarted the man. Yeah. I mean, is tribalism a good way to say it?
It is, and in group signaling. You're right. There was a study that came out again. I'm going to say late last week that talked about the idea anti-intellectualism really has become an ideological badge now, and people wear it with pride. And once that happens, it becomes, as I said, much more difficult to change people's minds. And in Canada, and probably even more so in the United States, you could go on the street, you can ask them maybe one or two questions, right? About, let's say in the context of COVID, you know, who did you vote for and are you vaccinated, right? And depending on what they answer, you can, I bet with about 80% accuracy, predict 20 other beliefs, right? There's this basket of beliefs that you have to adopt in order to be part of that group. You believe ivermectin works. You believe that the COVID deaths were exaggerated. You know, you believe, you know, on and on and on, right? The masks don't work. It's this basket of beliefs that really should be independent. You should assess the evidence on these things independently, right? Whenever you're forming your beliefs, but not anymore. You've become part of this group, and this is the basket of beliefs that you're supposed to adopt when you're part of this group. And there is really interesting research, Seth, that tells us that unfortunately this is a very effective strategy, because it becomes about the intuitively appealing ideology and not the misinformation. So you push the ideology and you can sidestep the misinformation. And we're seeing that also in the context of the fight against misinformation. Now it's about censorship and silencing. And I've even seen really respected journals like, you know, the Wall Street Journal recently had an op-ed that talked about how the fight against misinformation is going to cost lives. And that messaging works. They're arguing that fighting misinformation is going to result in a silencing of therapies that work. I've been in the space for a long time. You can't point to a single therapy that's been silenced, right? Not one in decades, right? Not one. But that narrative works is very, very powerful. And unfortunately, I think it's going to get stronger going forward, and it's going to make our job much more difficult.
Well, then the outgrouping, right? Speaking to tribalism, if you have the outgrouping, now we're talking about fear of the other, right? We demonize those who are outside. Now we're into the moral panic sphere, and you've written a lot about moral panic and spoken about it. You know, they're coming for us. They're everywhere. They want to strip us of our lives and our beliefs and our religion and our guns and our freedoms and our jobs and our whole country. It becomes this, it's fueled by panic. And of course, the people who are, you know, the panic pimps out there, they understand the power of weaponizing fear for their ends, right?
You're right. It is they who are coming for us, yeah. Right? And look, I think we need to be fair on this. It's happened on, I'm not going to say on both sides. I'm not going to say that.
I'm tracking. It's not a false equivalent argument to say that human tendencies are human tendencies.
Yeah, you know, I think there are examples of public health messaging that has been less than ideal. I'll put it that way, that has, kind of played to those, you know, that has made, has helped to polarize the public discourse. I think there's no doubt about it. And the other thing that happens, and I'm sure you experience this all the time, is they create these, again, these false dichotomies that play to their narrative that allows that tribalism to happen. So, because I am pro-vaccine, that means I'm anti-therapy. Like, I don't want, you know, there to be COVID therapies developed. Which of course is nonsense. You know, I work with a lot of public health researchers in Canada. I don't know a single person who wouldn't love a very effective COVID therapy to be established, right? Or wouldn't love ivermectin to work or hydroxychloroquine to. Of course, we want it to work, right? We don't have but that in-group signaling creates not only the basket of beliefs that that you're supposed to adopt, but also what the other, right? What they believe. And as I said, unfortunately, it's a really effective strategy.
I saw that you had shared an article, and if, you know, it's not immediate to your recall, we don't have to camp out here, but it kind of blew my mind. The article linked the $1 trillion health and wellness industry, right? This broad umbrella industry that encapsulates so much stuff. It's linked it to white supremacy.
Help me out with that. Give me the sort of the gist of what that is.
Yeah, this has been, again, a fascinating evolution. And again, I bet you've noticed this too. So I've been following, you know, the Gwyneth book is just one example, but we've actually done, you know, sort of empirical research around alternative medicine in the wellness industry. And it kind of started, you know, I think it was more associated with kind of lefties, you know, with, you know, wellness woo was, you know, new agey approach to health and, you know, sort of anti-corporate. But that evolution has shifted. And now it really has become part of the alt-right. You know, there's been a lot of really interesting articles about, you know, connecting, you know, yoga with QAnon. I know I got to be really careful here. I don't want yoga hate mail. I have people in my house do yoga. Maybe even today they'll be doing yoga. So I'm not.
Isn't yoga kind of like meditation, though? I mean, there are healthy ways to practice and there are woo-ish ways to do it.
Right? And if you enjoy these things, I totally get it. I totally get it. But these communities now are starting to become, you know, epicenters of conspiracy theories. And I think part of it, you know, a couple things are going on. One, it is the argument that you know, you're distrustful of conventional science, right? So that plays up for both communities, right? You're distrustful of authority. You've had maybe a bad experience with, you know, conventional healthcare. So all of those things, they overlap, you know, the alt-right and wellness community, they overlap. And then you definitely saw that with the vaccine world, the anti-vax community. And the other thing that's happening now is those who are spreading misinformation are targeting those groups, right? Because they know, you know, maybe they're parenting blogs, maybe there are broader wellness communities. They can target those communities with misinformation that caused even a further overlap to happen. So yeah, it's a very interesting development, especially for someone who's been, you know, sort of following this for so long, to see the degree to which that overlap has happened.
Talking here with Timothy Caulfield, let's end on the book, Your Day, Your Way, The Fact and Fiction Behind Your Daily Decisions. What's the book and what does it do, sir?
So the gimmick of the book, Seth, is it takes place over a typical day. And all the decisions we make throughout the day, you know, when to wake up, do you drink coffee, going to the bathroom, you know. I look at all the social forces that shape those decisions. And in part, it's a little bit of a Trojan horse book, because what I'm trying to do is use it to talk about those social forces and to highlight they impact all of us. You know, they impact you, they impact me, and to invite people to, you know, consider what the science actually says. And look, I make this point throughout several times. I don't expect everyone to live rationally, right? You know, if you enjoy a certain wine, that's awesome. If you enjoy doing yoga, that's awesome. The point is more to recognize those social forces, so fear-mongering, you know, corporate forces, you know, whatever they are, that shape our daily decisions. And I do try to have fun with it. I take, you know, some serious topics, but I also take, you know, toilet seat up, toilet seat down, parking your car. What is the evidence actually? There's actually evidence around how to park your car, Seth. I don't know if you knew that. So I try to do that. And then, of course, I end with recommendations on how to, you know, to see through the noise.
Is it true that, I mean, what I heard was it's actually safer to back your car up into the space. I don't know if that's true. I'll have to go look that one up. I looked for a main website for you, didn't find one. And what's the best way for people to connect with you if they want to follow your work, sir?
Well, they can find me at the University of Alberta website. I have that website, and follow me on Twitter, Caulfield Tim, and on Instagram. So all those places are great. And the other thing that we have, Seth, if I could give a shout out to our social media initiative called #ScienceUpFirst. #ScienceUpFirst. It's an initiative I co-founded. It's now taken on a life of its own. It's being run by people way smarter, way better, much more artistic than I am. But it really is an effort to create good content to be shared on social media. We use diverse voices, and I'm really proud of it. And Seth, it's been incredibly successful. We've had hundreds of millions of interactions, and all people have to do is follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, on TikTok. Come, please be part of the hashtag ScienceUpFirst team.
I will put all those links in the description box. Timothy Caulfield, keep debunking, my friend. Keep sciencing.
So much.
Keep educating, because I just love your work, and I think your work is tremendously needed. Thanks for being here today, brother.
Really appreciate it, Seth. Good time.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter for a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring The Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions. Log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.